All right, fantastic. Camille, thank you for joining me today. I'm Christy Cox, and as we mentioned, I'm writing a book to try to help other hypermobile EDS patients, and you have a wonderful story, and you're joining us today from the campus of VCU in Virginia, where you're getting a doctor of pharmacy. But in 2019, you were selected Miss Virginia after breaking tradition to perform a really engaging educational science demonstration, which I want to hear about. And then in December of 2019, you competed live and won the Miss America competition, the only woman to have ever had science help her with her talent performance to put this laser focus on STEM. I'm really excited to have you with me today. A lot of my fans are excited to hear from you and tell us about how you've, you know, remained flexible and, you know, handled being Miss America during a pandemic, and want to ask you about some of the advocacy work that you're doing. So tell us, you know, what all can we learn from both a beauty queen and a scholar who faces EDS? Like, how did you come to learn that you had joint hypermobility?
Well, I think saying that I'm flexible is the best way to describe a lot of different aspects of my life, both physically and mentally. Do I have to be flexible to be successful in all of the different realms that I work in? And that's been one of my strengths, despite my body part of the flexibility that doesn't always go well. I always had signs that pointed to joint hypermobility and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome from the day I was born. And it took 11 years for us to figure out that that was what I was dealing with. And it's pretty interesting because I want to say there's a statistic that says it takes between like 12 to 13 years for a patient who first exhibits symptoms to actually be diagnosed with EDS, which is kind of true for me because when I was born with my hips dislocated. And that was kind of the first symptom of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome that I experienced. And throughout my childhood, I always got hurt. I always bruised. I was always kind of clumsy. More than anything, I struggled with a lot of gastrointestinal and a lot of dental issues. I had a really high arched palate. I had teeth that didn't fit in my mouth. I went through braces and palate expanders and trying to figure out how to solve my orthodontic issues. And of course, that didn't seem very connected to my GI issues. But looking back, I think that that was exactly what it was connected with, which was Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. I eventually had a routine scoliosis screen at school that saw that I had signs of scoliosis. Of course, the school nurse couldn't diagnose me, so I got a note sent home. And I grew up outside of Philadelphia. I ended up going to an orthopedic surgeon at St. Christopher's Hospital in Philadelphia who was there to manage my scoliosis, but kind of touched my hands and immediately said, something else happening here, and started to do what I now know is a Baiten score. And he was assessing my hypermobility. And the really qualifying factor that makes it obvious that I have EDS is my skin. My skin is really soft. So he immediately was like, okay, I think you have a connective tissue thing or disorder going on right now. And he sent me to a geneticist, and it was a streamlined diagnosis, which was not the experience of many other EDS patients. And frankly, my diagnosis at age 11 answered 40 years of questions for my mom, because my mom found out that she had EDS because of me. And I obviously didn't have a positive family history at that time, just based on an official diagnosis, but my mom showed all of the signs. And so the geneticist was able to give an answer to both me and my mom. And the interesting part I will mention is that I was diagnosed in 2007, which is a light year different from now in genetics. There was not a lot of genetic testing available except for vascular EDS at the time. So my understanding was always that I had classical EDS. But as I now struggle more with EDS symptoms at 26, I am now seeing providers who think that I may have HEDS. And I am now seeking a genetic reevaluation and hopefully to get that genetic panel so that I will know officially what type of EDS I have. So my subtype is kind of in question, but the diagnosis is not. And I'm so grateful. And I will say that the biggest part of this entire story for me is the early diagnosis compared to my mom's later diagnosis. And I think that watching my mom struggle with chronic pain and surgeries and injuries and steroid injections and going through, she had a spinal fusion, she had rotator cuff injuries, she had so many things where she didn't know that she had this problem and potentially could have prevented a lot of the injuries in her life, that I have the opportunity to do as a person, a young person who knows that I have the diagnosis. And so we talked about the Norris lab, and the Norris lab at MUSC, who's trying to find that HEDS gene. When we look at this, by the way, the genetics can really play into patient care, giving us answers earlier is something that those genetic tests can do that often takes out kind of the like quantitative or like the subjective part of being a doctor. Like it's like, it's a test. It's a yes or no answer to a lot of patient cases. And so the diagnosis part is a huge part of what has made my EDS experience different from a lot of people who experience the same disorder.
Yeah. It took me 17 years.
Okay.
And it wasn't until, you know, my skull was sliding off the back of my spinal cord till they went, oh, this isn't just a hodgepodge of symptoms. Yeah. So I know you can appreciate that. And so tell us, you know, both metaphorically, literally, what is it like to, you know, wear the crown when you're facing EDS?
Yeah. I have always known that I had this disorder, and it explained a lot of kind of annoyances in my life, but it never really bothered me that much until I became kind of in my late teens, early 20s. I had injuries as a student athlete, and frankly, going through most of my undergraduate college experience and my grad school experience, the biggest implication that I have was chronic fatigue. And so when I decided to compete for Miss America and Miss Virginia, I was most concerned of how I would be able to maintain the role with the fatigue that I have. I wasn't so much worried about the pain and everything else that I'm now experiencing, but just being able to do the job, because I would experience brain fog. I would experience this exhaustion level that wouldn't necessarily be rectified with sleep. And frankly, being Miss America is not a restful job. The job is really traveling 20,000 miles a month, moving hotels every night, every day to a new location, and being on the whole day, and frankly, being the one to make everybody else feel comfortable. So you are the socialite in the room to make everyone else very excited and comfortable. And I'm a natural introvert and I'm a tired person. And so filling that role, I can do it, but it taxes my system in a way that maybe it wouldn't for someone else. So when I won, I was really worried about how I would actually physically execute the role. For the first 3 months, I traveled almost nonstop and got really drained really quickly. And then COVID happened 3 months into my experience. And I will say that despite the fact that COVID is a terrible implication that we've had in the last 2 years, I was really excited about the idea of having to go home when they said, you know, you might have to go home for 2 weeks to stop the spread. Go take some time and we'll figure out how we're going to move forward. And then of course, 2 weeks became 4 and 5 months at home before people could figure out how to do things in person or if we could. And as we learned more about the disease, COVID made it so that I was able to do my job differently. So I transitioned from being an in-person Miss America to being a virtual Miss America. I did most of my events moving forward after organizations were able to figure out how to work with a virtual platform. That's how I did my events. I was able to travel virtually throughout the country by sitting at my desk and logging into Zoom. And then I was able to create these videos that live on forever just through, you know, content creation. I did a whole PBS series with PBS here in Central Virginia, and it was called Cooking Up Science with Miss America. So projects like that allowed me to do the job that I wanted to do and make the impact that I wanted to make without taxing my body in the way that a traditional Miss America would have had to do. And for that, I'm really grateful. And a lot of people who are very big fans of Miss America will assume or ask me about, you know, am I disappointed in my experience? And I'm absolutely not. I couldn't be any more grateful for the way that my job changed as a person with a chronic illness to allow me to serve that role in a way that worked for my body in such a serendipitous way. And frankly, to talk about science, because that was the way that I helped to get my job and then to be able to advocate for science and science education during a pandemic was just the perfect fit. So that's kind of how I've done Miss America with EDS. And of course, now my role has come to an end as of December 2021. And now I'm just a full-time grad student again.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that, your scholarly pursuits.
Yeah. I have always loved science from the time I was a little girl. And saying that you love science or STEM is such a broad category. So I had to figure out what I really liked about it and what I wanted to pursue in my career. I thought about being an engineer. I started college as an engineering major and then kind of realized that although I liked a lot about science and engineering, it wasn't necessarily that field that was a good match for me. So I transitioned into biochemistry. I got a bachelor's in biochemistry and a bachelor's in something called systems biology from Virginia Tech. And I interned with a pharmaceutical company during that time and realized that pharmacists could work outside of a drugstore, which was really perplexing to me, but now seems so naive. And I loved medicine. I loved biology and I loved chemistry and I loved how it affected the body. But I didn't want to be a nurse like my mom. I didn't really want to touch people. I didn't really want to put IVs in and you know, cut people open. So pharmacy became a really viable option for me to learn about medicine, to learn about healthcare, but not necessarily be touching people directly or interacting. Interacting with the public is a lot of what pharmacists do, but it's a lot less hands-on than other health professions. And so it was a great fit. And I felt like there were so many things I could do with it. And so I entered pharmacy school in 2018. I took 2 years away from my pharmacy education to serve as Miss Virginia and then Miss America. And I returned back in August of 2021. And I will tell you that when I returned to school is when my EDS symptoms became worse than they have ever been in my entire life. Mm. And I don't know what the trigger was, if it was maybe just the right time for the symptoms to start emerging again, if it was the change in my lifestyle again, if I just wasn't able to maintain that same lifestyle the way that I was when I was a first year pharmacy student 2 years before. But going back in August, that was the first time that I said, okay, this is how my life might be forever. And I'm going to now have to deal with chronic pain, dizziness, fatigue, and all of these things at once. And also now have to navigate the healthcare system and find providers to support me that I don't have. That was a little bit overwhelming, but has made me better understand how to function with EDS. And I now have to modify the way that I go through my graduate program to allow myself to be successful with the disorder that I have. So some of the things that I do, I have an ergonomic setup at my desk so that I'm not straining. I also have craniocervical instability, just like you. So I'm constantly making sure that I'm in the right position. I'm in physical therapy every single week. I take naps almost every day when I come home. I am not officially diagnosed, but 99% sure with my providers that I have POTS. Me too. I am increasing my salt intake. I am sitting here drinking a liquid IV to increase my fluids and trying to do light exercise when I can to keep my cardiac tone. It has been a transition for me to learn how to be a student with chronic disease, because I've always been a student and I've always had chronic disease, but I've never had to deal with them simultaneously in the way that I have this year. So that has been the biggest change. It has not yet affected my academics, but it has eaten up most of my personal time outside of school. So I am no longer able to do a lot of the fun things that I could do in school because I had more energy and I had less things to do in terms of taking care of myself. So my own self-care has been now a higher priority and has to be for me to then be successful academically. And that's been one of the biggest transitions thus far.
And that self-care is so critical. And as I say, you know, it's not selfish. You have to do it. I mean, there's no choice.
It feels selfish sometimes, honestly. Even when I'm not able to see people that I want to see because I'm too tired to get together to socialize, or I have to say no to things, even though I want to go because I know that I need to rest or I need to go to the doctor, or go to the grocery store to make sure that I have food to eat through the week. So I'm not scrambling. There's so many things that I have to do to prevent a lot of the flares and symptoms that I have. And it takes me away from a lot of the things that I might like to do, but I also have to just say, okay, I can do that when I feel better or when I have energy to do it, but I can totally empathize with that. We need the self-care. It's important. Yeah.
I mean, it's very important, and learning to change your lifestyle to be able to fit, you know, your chronic illness in is a very, very hard lesson to learn. It takes a long time, but it sounds like you've really got the right mindset and you're really mastering it. So that's wonderful. So tell me a little bit about, you have a platform about Mind Your Meds for drug safety and abuse prevention. So tell me about that.
Yes. So one of the great parts about competing for Miss America is that at any level in the program, you are charged to start your own social initiative with something that you're passionate about. And when I was searching for mine, I was like, what am I already doing? Because I don't want this to just be something I came out with because I had to. As a pharmacy student, one of the main things that I've realized that pharmacists do is patient education. That's the big thing that makes pharmacists different, because we are providing these medications, but we are charged to help that patient understand them and take them safely. So I was really interested in the idea of safe medication administration, both with over-the-counter and prescription medicines. But it would be kind of, you know, disingenuous to not talk about the downsides that can come with some medications, like pain medications, opioids specifically, and how they can negatively impact our communities. And so I learned about Narcan. I learned how to administer it and looking for signs of opioid overdoses in people, understanding what substance use disorder was. So as Miss America and as Miss Virginia, my main focus was decreasing stigma around substance use, providing really accurate, factual, scientific information around addiction, how these things can happen and how to prevent them from happening in your life, and helping people understand how to safely take substances if they are prescribed them or if they purchase them, and how to keep their kids safe. And that was something that I was learning already in my pharmacy program and is something that I intend to do long-term. And so that was actually really relevant going into Miss America. It's more relevant now because of COVID and the way that really staying at home and the pandemic has affected mental health and increased the number of overdoses and substance use within this country. It's been really sad to see. So I was hoping that through the end of my time, I would see a decrease in the number of overdose deaths, but unfortunately it's almost doubled because of the pandemic. And so I'll keep fighting that fight, and it's something that I hope to continue to do long-term.
Yeah, that's great. So we've talked a little bit about the ways that you manage EDS and the challenging parts for you. You know, what would you tell, you know, someone that's struggling either to get a diagnosis or to give them a level of, you know, promise of hope on the horizon?
It's hard for me to empathize with struggling to get a diagnosis because I'm so lucky to have gotten mine early. But I will say that I think that the actual diagnosis of EDS is incredibly important to have if you think that you are struggling with the disorder, because unfortunately with a lot of invisible illness, it's difficult to explain the symptoms that you're going through to a new provider who might not be familiar with the disorder or the way that these things are connected. And unfortunately, a lot of providers will question the validity of those symptoms without an official diagnosis on your record. So fighting for that diagnosis will give you the confidence and the ability to advocate for yourself as a patient moving forward in the duration of your life and as you navigate healthcare. And I think that it's so important that we understand what we are going through. For me, knowing the diagnoses that I have and knowing that what I feel every day isn't necessarily normal, but is something that I know what it is and I don't have to ask questions of why it's happening, helps me mentally deal with having a chronic illness in a way that maybe if I didn't know it was happening to me, I would be much more anxious instead of saying, it's my EDS today. I know that it's not going to hurt me. I know that it's just uncomfortable and I'm going to move forward. The other thing that I would say is that with or without the diagnosis, dealing with chronic disease does not have to change your goals. It doesn't necessarily have to negatively impact your life. You can shape your life around it. You can still do so many things. Maybe you won't be able to do certain things that you used to be able to do. For me, I used to be able to work out in a way that I can't work out anymore. I have to be really cautious with the way that I exercise my body because of my POTS and my EDS and my joints. I couldn't do the same things as I could a couple of years ago. And instead of focusing on all the things that I can no longer do, I really focus on the things that I am able to do because I'm still able to do so many things and so many more things than even some EDS patients can. I'm still ambulatory. I don't have to use mobility aids at this point in my life. I'm still able to exercise. I'm still able to go and take my dogs for walks and go shopping and do all these wonderful things that I like to do like anybody else. And I stay really grateful for the things that my body can offer me. And unfortunately, sometimes we go through those phases where we learn more things that are wrong with us and it can be really discouraging. But instead of focusing on that, which I can understand why we do sometimes because it's easy to, really just remaining grateful for the things that we do have, because I don't want to say it could always get worse, but it probably could always be worse. And so where we are right now may be the best form that we could be in the near future. And so every day waking up and saying, you know, this is a good day today. I'm happy for what I have and tomorrow could be different.
You know, I'm a firm believer in the same mindset. And, you know, that's a lot of what I'm talking about in my book is, you know, you have to kind of master your ability to, you know, look on the bright side of the clouds, because there are so many wonderful things that are still remaining, because it's too easy to get, you know, kind of almost sucked into the vortex. So
it is, and it can feel when you get all of these things, when you have the craniocervical instability, when you have EDS, when you have POTS, and it feels like everything is like my body's breaking, I'm dizzy, I can't do the things that I want. It can get really overwhelming. And some days, I will also say, some days are really overwhelming, but some days are better. And focusing on the days that are better. And when you have a really bad day, I have plenty of days where I feel absolutely horrible. And I just say, you know what? I feel really horrible today. I'm going to take care of myself and do what I can to make myself feel better, and allowing yourself the time to recover if you're not feeling well, instead of feeling like you constantly have to push through pain, allowing yourself to stop. Because I think right now, a lot of us, maybe we're better at it now working from home, but we've been kind of taught that we have to be this superhuman person that pushes through every piece of discomfort in our life and not show it or acknowledge it, but to give the pain that we experience an acknowledgement and say, I feel you. I'm going to do something different so that maybe we can make this feel better. Allowing yourself to do that has been, or at least allowing myself to do that has been really important. Because I feel like I don't have to suffer. I feel like I'm allowed to take care of myself and do something differently to feel better.
Well, I know I'm going to run out of your time. Thank you so much. I want to make sure that you have the opportunity to share, you know, what you're doing for the EDS community. And then, you know, what maybe you wish the world knew about EDS that they might not right now, you know, and how can the community help, you know, spread the love.
I have been really lucky to serve as an advocate for the EDS community nationwide, really. The biggest thing that I'm able to do is spread awareness of what the disorder looks like. I talk a lot with healthcare professionals because of my involvement in the pharmacy space. And it's been really interesting to help educate providers on what EDS looks like. There is still a perception in a lot of healthcare systems that EDS looks more debilitating than it does. I don't look sick. I am one of the EDS patients that does not look like I have a chronic disease, but I absolutely do. Being able to show that patients can be functional with this type of disorder, and maybe that some of us are really good actors and are able to hide it, but that we absolutely do have struggles that need support from them. Emphasizing listening to patients. I've learned how to conduct patient interviews myself through my own healthcare program and giving those patients the opportunity to tell you frankly what's going on in their life and believing them. I have shown the experience of early diagnosis for a lot of patients, but also I think that I've started to be able to help other people who struggle recognize that they have EDS. And that's been one of the most rewarding pieces of what I do. I do a lot of that through social media and sharing my own experiences with the disorder. And some people are like, hey, I go through that. Can you tell me a little bit more about EDS or maybe how it affects you? That's been one of the most satisfying pieces of doing what I do. I think that the biggest thing that those of us with EDS can do is advocate for ourselves and advocate for each other, especially in the healthcare space, because there still is a gap there where we are not necessarily treated as, you know, I don't want to say that it's not important, but, you know, this is not often a life-threatening condition. It's a life-altering condition, and it affects our quality of life, but not necessarily our length of life for most patients. But that does not discredit the discomfort that we experience, and helping each EDS patient understand how to advocate for themselves and then encourage our providers to better understand the disorder so that they can serve other people with hypermobility disorders even better is something that I'm really passionate about. And it can sometimes be really uncomfortable because you feel like you're annoying, at least with doctors. I'm like, I think I have this. Can we run this test? I read this article about this, and they're like, are you like a WebMD doctor? And I'm like, no, I do a lot of work in the space, and I know that what I'm experiencing could be something else. And I will say that it's the other final thing that I'll say about EDS. It is always known, or it was always known as a rare disease. I don't think it's a rare disease. I really don't. And there is data that shows this. I don't have the actual article that it came from, but I think that the estimation is that instead of like 1 in 10,000, that EDS could be more like 1 in 500.
That's what I hear. Yeah.
And I absolutely believe that. And so I'm hoping that as we start to better understand the disorder and realize that it's more common, that more people will understand how to help support us and how to help treat us. Of course, we can't cure it, but how to make us more comfortable. And then further down the line, can we identify this in patients earlier and really have a wonderful setup of how to deal with having this hypermobility disorder from childhood on to prevent a lot of the implications? Screening for craniocervical instability, screening for POTS at younger ages, instead of having to just kind of leave us on our own and have to figure these out ourselves. So there's a lot of growth that's happening. And I am excited that I get to watch it happen and be a part of it.
I am too. You know, the 1 in 500 is looking like the data point. And, you know, for me, that means it's not rare. It's rarely diagnosed. So,
and that's what makes me sad for patients that don't have the same experience that I do in knowing. And I just feel very lucky that I've had the experience that I have, and I try to take, you know, to be cognizant of that and pay that forward, really, in a way, knowing that I have such a unique and beneficial experience dealing with this to help other people find answers or prevent them from having to go through what a lot of EDS patients do.
And you'll be able to make choices in your life that will help you. And, you know, sometimes people, when they don't know, you know, they end up having to redo their, I'm having to kind of redo my life and my career, but, you know, I'm grateful to be able to do it, but yeah. So I know you need to go.
I was going to say, I'm also trying to prevent needing a spinal fusion like what you have, because I now know I have the instability. And so I have preventative care now that I can try to resolve my neck issues before they get worse. So well,
you know who to see at MUSC. So
yeah. And he has a collaborator because I'm close to DC. Well, do you know Dr. Fraser Henderson?
I do.
I see Dr. Henderson, who's okay. A little bit closer, but Patel and Henderson are both incredible neurosurgeons. So they're great.
I saw them both and then had my surgery at MUSC. So yeah, you're in good hands. Absolutely. And, you know, stave off the surgery as long as you can. Yeah. So to wrap up, I want to ask a fun question. What's the coolest thing you did as Miss America?
Gosh. Can I have two answers?
And I have to tell you that some of the people that are my fans wanted me to ask you, how did you manage walking down the runway in those heels when you have EDS? But tell us the coolest things.
So, well, the heels, I'll tell you, I struggle with the heels, but I have trained after many, many times in walking them, my ankles have become much stronger than they would have been. But the strength really and the stability go together clearly. So I have done pretty well in them because I've had a lot of practice in them, but I have fallen down steps in them. And I did it Miss America backstage. I fell down an entire flight of steps in my dress during a rehearsal. It's harder to walk down the stairs in the shoes than it is to walk on flat ground, especially hard ground is easier. So it's difficult, but the strengthening helps. The two coolest things I got to do as Miss America, I got to speak at the United Nations, which was amazing. I was there on International Day of Women and Girls in Science, and I spoke about just being a woman in STEM and the things that might affect a woman's ability to pursue a STEM career worldwide, and how maybe the issues that I would face as a woman in STEM might be different than a woman in Africa or somewhere else in the country or in the world that might have different access than what I had. So it was really interesting to talk about that. And the most fun thing that I got to do, I went on a USO tour. So like the Bob Hope USO tours that happened for so long, those still continue. And I went with the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and we did a 10-day excursion throughout the United States and went to Cuba as well and visited military service members and their families, because we were on domestic soil. So there were a lot of families and kids there, and we were able to really understand more about what military service looks like and thank a lot of the members. That was just such an incredible trip to go on, and is really an iconic Miss America trip that has existed since Vietnam. And I got to be a little bit of part of history in that. So that one was just, I just had so much fun on that trip. It was probably the best thing I got to do.
Oh, that is so cool. I could talk to you for a lot longer. Thank you so much for your time. Absolutely. If you need any referrals to any local doctors, since we learned we're local.
Yes.
And, you know, take good care of yourself and, you know, be well.
Thank you. And stay in touch. I'd love to catch up about EDS stuff at another time too. And I'll send you my phone number. And if you have any more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Camille. Take care.
Thank you. See, it's nice to meet you.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye.